Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
I'm Jim Boyle, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport, and presented and introduced today by Jim Boyle, one of our Kickstarter backers who has helped this Tennis Podcast exist in 2017. And hopefully you'll all agree that it has flourished as well. So thank you very much, Jim, for backing us. Catherine Whittaker and I are back together, sort of. We're not in the same place, but we're on the same line. Catherine, we've got loads to talk to you about today. Not only the fact that we missed out on your thoughts of the US Open because you were ill for several days on end. Don't need to remind you about that. We've had loads of tournaments. We've had the Davis Cup. We've got Tokyo to talk about. We've just had Laver Cup, which has really caught the imagination of a lot of people. And we'll have a good old debate about that. We'll hear from Simon Briggs, who was there from The Telegraph. I had a chat with him earlier today. We'll play you that. And most importantly, Catherine Whittaker, you appear to have a new forehand that I do not want any part of.
Yeah, I'm so glad that video evidence was captured of that forehand by my brother, not upon my asking, I have to say. I've spent the week, it feels like a hazy, distant memory now, unfortunately, but it was very vivid at the time. I spent the week at La Manga in Spain, Well, for me, it was a tennis holiday, but I think you can do all sorts of other, most people there were on a golf holiday. And when I told them I was playing tennis, they said, oh, tennis, great. And I've got a new forehand. It's quite good. It's erratic. It's always the way with coaching, isn't it? It's two steps forward, one step back. And unfortunately, the one step back is always so fantastically frustrating. What people don't say enough about tennis, David, is obviously it's wonderful. You know, we have dedicated our lives to it and have no regrets. It's a wonderful, wonderful sport, but it is the most fantastically difficult sport on the planet, I believe. I mean, I've not tried every sport. I've said this, I think, before on the podcast, but I had a pretty lucky childhood in that I was one of those kids that went to a class or a lesson at some point or another of most sports and activities. And tennis is by far the most difficult sport. And people don't say that enough, but I'm saying it. It's wonderfully, and the fact that it's so difficult makes it, you know, the tiny improvements that you do make are fantastically satisfying. And the whole week was, it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. A Whittaker family tennis holiday. What could be better?
You did look particularly happy with yourself and particularly pleased with that forehand. And I'm quite pleased to discover that it's erratic, because on first viewing, I did immediately withdraw my rematch request. But might think again now.
When I'm being fed lovely clean balls by a coach and they're sitting up at just the right height and he's shouting all the right instructions to me, it's not erratic. It's bang on, and I felt like Steffi Graf. But then when I get into a match situation and the ball isn't in exactly the right place and my feet aren't in exactly the right place, it becomes slightly erratic. But I have promised Rafa, my coach for the week, that I would not go back to my old less top spinny forehand that I wouldn't go back to my old grip. So I have to. I'm on a path now, David.
You had a coach called Rafa.
I had a coach called Rafa. He did all the obligatory Nadal jokes. I think you had some Rafa time as well when you were in La Manga.
No, I saw him from afar. He was way above my level, I'm afraid, so I wasn't allowed to have coaching with him.
He turned pro. He actually works as a hitting partner at the events in Madrid and Beijing, and on another less congested podcast. I will perhaps offer up the insights that he gave me into the life of a sparring partner, as he called it, because it was really interesting. I mean, that's sort of a role that we're aware of and know exists, but we don't sort of ever hear that much about it. But it was all very interesting, no. And I've got a new forehand, and I'm very pleased about it, tentatively. Because I always think with because I spend all as you do, spend all my time watching tennis and around tennis players, I sort of somehow think that by osmosis or something, I should be better than I am. Do you know what I mean?
I know, like, I've got another 15 years in the bank.
I've been watching Federer for the last 2 weeks, so obviously my game is going to be a bit more Federer-like, and it just doesn't work like that. But if you do want to become just that fraction more Federer-like, I can highly recommend A Week in La Manga.
There you go. Catherine Whittaker. And the coaching special will be coming soon. And the rematch will, because I am up for this.
It's pretty annoying. Annoying when you're having a joint coaching session with your brother and he starts being used as the demo for your coaching.
Yeah, he's far too good for our liking.
Yeah.
Anyway, talking about watching Federer, we've been doing a bit of that the last few days as well, because Laver Cup has been on and it has been creating a lot of discussion. If you didn't get to see it, now a lot of people in Britain were extremely frustrated on Sunday because... Catherine Whittaker was one of them.
I can barely participate in this Laver Cup discussion because I wasn't able to watch this famous climax that you're about to describe.
Oh, dear. That's going to really not go down well at all. Well, basically, in the UK, it was on Sky Sports and they kept shifting around the channel that it was on and then sticking it behind the red button. If it was behind the red button, it meant it didn't work on iPads, on Sky Go, and people's signal was going down and we were getting all sorts of people tweeting us and saying, this is so frustrating, you telling us how good it is and we can't even watch it. So that's obviously something that needs ironing out in the future. But if you didn't get to hear about what this event was, basically they were trying to create a tennis version of the Ryder Cup. And it's all done by Roger Federer and his management company, who just created this from scratch. Basically, they'd got their own sponsors, all of his sponsors on board. And they'd got Tennis Australia and the USTA behind it. They'd got Rod Laver in place, who it was named after. They'd got team captains of John McEnroe captaining Team World and Bjorn Borg captaining Team Europe. They had... well, many of the best players from those particular locations, continents in place. And so Europe had Federer, Nadal, Dominic Thiem, Alexander Zverev, Thomas Berdych and Marin Cilic. And Team World had Nick Kyrgios and Sam Querrey, John Isner. Francis Tiafoe was drafted in as a replacement for Juan Martín Del Potro. Denis Shapovalov was there. That was the lineup. It was meant to be a black court. Have to say, it looked grey to me. But anyway, it was the idea was for it to be blended black, and team colours of blue for Europe, red for the States, which I thought worked particularly well on TV. They really popped out of the screen. 3-day event, escalating point system, and then a climax on Sunday. And it was. I mean, I thought it was an amazing climax, but I'm sorry to rub that in, Catherine. Just before we speak to Simon Briggs, your initial thoughts?
Oh, my initial thoughts are myriad, so I'll try and distill it down to sort of a positives and a negatives column, and then after we've heard from Simon, whose opinions are far, well, certainly very, very relevant because he was there on site, we'll go into it in a bit more detail. But my instinct is to be very positive about it, because I think anybody that's pouring a lot of money into something which could potentially bring a new audience, a big audience to the sport, I think our instinct should be positive about it. And there is no doubt that money is being poured into this. It is dripping in money, and I think there are positives and negatives within that. I mean, the word slick is a word, I heard Simon use it in the piece we're about to hear from him, and it's a word that when we were exchanging texts about it, it's a word that came up a lot. It was so slick, you know, that I think there were tiny elements about it that were just a bit over slick, just a bit overproduced, but basically, you know, trying to be positive about it, it was very well done and well executed, and that was partly due to the money that's been poured into it, partly due to, you know, obviously very good event management, all of that. I think there are issues with legitimacy, and they're not necessarily all specific to what they're doing, and I think there's a fundamental issue with you cannot make something matter from nowhere. You can't conjure that out of the blue. They're doing everything they can by getting Rod Laver on board and calling it the Laver Cup and forging the trophy from one of his old, I think it was forged from an old US Open trophy. You know, they're doing everything they can to artificially create meaning. But the problem is you can't artificially create meaning. And that's not their fault. That's not anything specific to the event. But and I don't know how you deal with that going forward. But I have a lot more thoughts than that, and I'm sure you do as well, David. But I think probably we should hear from Simon because he was there.
Well, I think we were not sure what to expect when we arrived, and we were all surprised by the vibrancy of the thing, really. The intent of the players, the size of the crowds, and the slickness of the presentation. You know, that black court really worked on TV, because obviously we did watch some of it on TV. I thought it really worked in the arena as well. It was really hard to work out, you know, where the weak spots were. I mean, you don't want to be too overexcited about a new product, which, you know, may have a limited lifespan, who knows. But at the same time, when people get it right, people get it right.
Yeah, you mentioned the court. Just quickly on that, did it look more black in person? Because on TV it looked grey.
Yeah, I actually quite liked that grey thing, because I think it was Mike Dixon's wife who said that watching it at home, it looked like a PlayStation game, and I quite liked that about it. It looked like everything else was in monochrome, didn't it? With the colour spots of the two blue and red shirts. But in person, it did look more sort of velvety, a little bit like a sort of jewellery box that you might have sort of got a ring out of. And that was just part of the whole show that just seemed to gel, in the sense of everything about it was a slightly new look. And, you know, variety in tennis, which can get a little bit identikit, particularly in the dog days of October. Variety is a huge asset.
Yeah, no, I can see where you're coming from. I read your piece this morning. If you haven't read Simon's piece yet, do get a look at it, because it gives you a full roundup of the weekend and this pretty extraordinary climax in terms of how it felt. I mean, watching on TV, I was watching with my kids, and we were really into it by the end, you know, that Kyrgios-Federer match. One thing you did say in your piece, which Catherine had mentioned to me last night, just in passing in terms of a query, and something you just alluded to, it could have been scripted, couldn't it?
Yeah.
That was the agreement that the two teams decided, right, well, what we need to make sure is that this is still properly alive at the end, and that Federer is playing Kyrgios for the Laver Cup. And then maybe we'll let that play out. That is a possibility. What was your feeling?
Yes, and that is the one biggest weakness of the tournament. Not that it was necessarily scripted, but that we cannot know. Because, you know, on the level of point-by-point construction, tennis players can arrange things on a level that is hard to detect for an outsider. You know, Rafa did miss three easy forehands. Sorry, I'm in the airport, so you're getting the the announcement now about boarding call somewhere near me. Rafa did miss three easy forehands at the end of the first set of his match against Isner. Having said that, is he such a good actor that he can maintain that level of intense engagement as a spectator and as a player for the whole of the 3 days, and then deliberately go out and lose a match? So that's not convincing either. I mean, I think the balance of probabilities, it probably wasn't scripted, but you can't know. And that is the weakness of it, because there's no ranking points and it's not being played for a trophy that has a history or a standing in the sport. That's where the one question mark against the Labour Cup has to be found.
The other one, I think, is the fact that the point system does mean that it's pretty much always going to be live, isn't it, on the final day. Now, that's a strength in as much as you're guaranteed entertainment, you're guaranteed value for your ticket and the broadcasting rights and so forth. But strictly speaking, that isn't sport.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly argue that it feels a little bit contrived. On the other hand, you could also argue that by giving a ratcheting number of points, you're encouraging teams to put their biggest names on for the biggest rewards, and that is a kind of there's a kind of logic in there somewhere. But I take your point. If Roger had lost against Kyrgios, then the points would have been level, but it would have been 7-5 to Europe in actual matches won and lost. Which it's not a sort of huge sort of inequality between 7-5 and the tied points overall, but it's where entertainment meets sport, isn't it? And that's the kind of the awkward nexus that you're dealing with in the Labour Cup. And that, at a certain extent, I think we've talked about this before, that applies to the whole of tennis, because tennis isn't absolutely fair, whether you look at wild cards, for instance, or scheduling. Things are slightly stacked in favour of the star draws. So it's a more obvious problem here, but not necessarily a problem that is exclusive to Labour Cup.
And actually, if you look at any match in isolation, you will often see a situation whereby one player has won more points during a match but has lost the match because they haven't won what we might call the big points, the ones that decide the vital games. So, I mean, you know, it is easy to get a little churlish, I think, about these things. But at the same time, I don't think we're doing our job, are we, if we don't draw attention to the fact that that this is a talking point at the very least, whether we decide, whether tennis decides, whether the media decide, whether the fans decide to overlook that and say, well, actually, it was just a fantastic weekend of entertainment and sport and we really enjoyed it and we want more of it. That will, I guess, stand, you know, come out in the course of time.
Yes, I think that's the point, isn't it? That it's very difficult to know where an event like this will go in the long term. Even Roger admitted that was the first thing he said, actually, after beating Kyrgios, was time will tell how big the Labour Cup will become. And one other point is, you know, it's not necessarily going to have the advantage of being able to field a Roger-Rafa doubles duo on each occasion. And again, this is a point that goes beyond Labour Cup, because the sport as a whole faces an existential crisis when those two players do stop competing against each other and the rest of the field. So, you know, it's just a fantastic start for it.
Yeah,
you can't say for sure where any of these questions will go. I think you're right. You've got to raise the point of collusion. Is it possible that it happened? You've got to raise the point of the ratcheting score system. Does it feel right? I think it got away with everything for the moment. Let's see how next year goes.
The other thing is, Simon, beyond the stadium, it's very easy to become intoxicated when you're there, isn't it? Because the atmosphere is amazing and the view would be, oh, even if you're maybe a cynical old hack,
I certainly know about that.
Well, you're watching it and I think it's impossible not to get swept up in it, really, because of it was great. It was there were moments in there at the end where Rafael Nadal is jumping into the arms of Roger Federer, and then the two of them are embraced by Bjorn Borg, and you got John McEnroe just staring broodily at them all. Come on, those are moments that, regardless of whatever else happens, we can't forget those. And then you've got Rod Laver honoured in the middle of the court. You know, the guy is not going to be with us forever. It was wonderful in that respect. The thing, there is a couple of things here. One is, generally speaking, can people get behind a team called World in the long run? Because, you know, it's going to go to Chicago next. An American team, an audience would massively get behind an American team the way they do in Ryder Cup. I think Team Europe has been proven to work by Ryder Cup if the opposition is such that there's a strength of feeling, and there is in Ryder Cup against the United States. But can it work with Team World in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought so. The partisanship in Prague wasn't as great as it would have been for a Davis Cup match. So the identification with the players and the teams wasn't as great as if they were playing for their country. And people were actually rooting for Isner to beat Rafa because they wanted to see Roger. And so, again, a broader point about tennis, it's the least partisan national sport. It's one of the few sports in which a lot of people, for instance, would support Roger Federer against Andy Murray in the UK. Not because they necessarily don't like Andy Murray, but because everyone loves Roger. It's very much a performance type of sport. It's very aesthetic. And people tend to gravitate towards personalities and styles that they actually relate to. So what you've got here is almost a way of projecting the personalities in a team format. And I think one vital element of the whole thing was this sense of the reaction shots, whether you were watching it live, whether you're watching it on TV, the sense of other players reacting to their teammates, their opponents, and what was happening on the court, the captains doing that too. You know, that exists in Davis Cup, but it was certainly much more free and expressive and full of personality here than I can remember it ever at a Davis Cup match, because almost the informality of the setting allowed it to be more fun. And so you had all those crazy routines that the World team were doing, the archery stuff and the imaginary slam dunks in a basketball hoop and all sort of falling down on the floor. It was less about identifying with either the World or Europe than it was about getting a window into the personalities of the players and seeing them in a different light and bringing them out in a more colourful way.
Mm. That's interesting. There are going to be some interesting questions for you and your colleagues and myself and my colleagues in the broadcast media to ask of the ATP and the ITF, isn't there, in the future, about what they've made of this weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the problem for the ATP is that their tour is almost always the same in terms of the format. And I think this weekend has shown that, as I say, variety is very important. The problem with the Davis Cup is that it's just lost the confidence of the leading players, and they're almost wanting to put a stick in the eye of the ITF because they feel, rightly or wrongly, that they're not getting a fair deal and that they're not being led in a confident or smart way by the powers that be. So both of them will have to decide how seriously to take it. If they don't take it seriously, I think that would be foolish, because it's shown that innovation can achieve an awful lot.
Should they embrace it?
Well, they're not going to be able to kill it. I think we've seen that already. So constructive cooperation would be sensible. If the Labour Cup does dwindle, it won't be because of anything the ATP or ITF do, I would say. So we might as well get round the table.
Mm, interesting. Final question, Simon. From a media standpoint, how is this going to grow in your view? Let's put it simply. Will you be in Chicago a year from now?
Well, we were discussing that. There is an issue here that almost certainly Great Britain will lose to Spain in the first Davis Cup round next year. And that would mean that there is a Davis Cup relegation battle for Great Britain the week before Labour Cup. And, you know, for all the criticism of the ITF and the tournament, that still means a lot. So in terms of our schedules, we're probably not going to want to go to both, because we've got the US Open immediately before it. And I think we probably will still go for the Davis Cup rather than the Labour Cup. So that possibly gives you a sense of realism as to how far this has come. It's been a fantastic splash, but you've got a 117-year-old competition which exists already. And so I think that possibly puts a little bit of proportion on what we're talking about, that, you know, at this stage I would expect to be at Davis Cup instead.
Very interesting. Well, it has been a fascinating weekend, no matter what happens from here. Simon, glad you enjoyed it. Hopefully you get a little bit of a break now. Lovely to talk to you as always.
Thanks, David.
So there's Simon Briggs, who was there throughout the Labour Cup weekend, Catherine. Fascinating to hear his insight. And I can imagine getting swept up in it when you're there. I mean, he and his colleagues will have done their utmost to keep a detached view as best they can. I have to say, I was really swept up with it during the final session. But overall, the points that we were discussing there about the point system, and I mean, you know, the query, and I should say, I don't think it was fixed personally. I maybe I'm naive, but I don't. I think looking at the reactions of the players, they would have to be the best actors on. They should go to Hollywood now. Forget tennis, because if they can produce those reactions without being genuine, I don't know how they've done it. That's very impressive.
Yeah, should we address the subject of the fixing or the not fixing or the speculation about the fixing? Should we just address that as a single unit of debate? I think if it was fixed in some way, I certainly don't think it was, as you know, sort of put it to Simon, was it scripted? I absolutely don't think it was scripted. I don't think there was any official discussion or instruction or, you know, let's have it come down to the final match. I think... And it's quite possible that my years spent on the Champions Tour, where this sort of thing, I'm sure it won't be a surprise to anyone, went on. It's quite possible that I'm hardened and cynical from that. I do accept that. But I think if it was not entirely genuine, that was due to players sort of taking it upon themselves or, you know, an unspoken thing, a sort of we... are a part of this event. We want it to be a success. We know, you know, it's like, you know, Thomas Enquist wants to be invited back to the Albert Hall next year. So he realises that possibly beating Tim Henman and knocking him out of the tournament might not be the best thing. You know, I think it would come more from that sort of a place rather than an active scripting. I have no idea if that happened. And I agree with you. There would have been some very, very cynical acting going on if that were the case. And it's possible that it was somewhere in the middle, you know, that those forehands that Rafa missed against Isner, he didn't deliberately, consciously make the decision, I'm going to dump these into the net. But equally, it was somewhere in the back of his mind that it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if he lost that match. Do you know what I mean? Like, it could have been... I don't think it's as binary as was it scripted or not scripted. I've no idea. I want to believe in it. I think there's a very good chance it was all legit. But equally, as Simon expressed very eloquently, the very problem is the fact that we're questioning it, isn't it? Not what the answer is. The fact is that we're asking the question, and that is a problem, because you wouldn't ask the question with the Ryder Cup. You just wouldn't.
No. Although I just can't imagine that from Nadal. I don't think he knows any other way than to just play outright.
These guys play exhibitions and charity matches, and for sure they you know, no one's beating anyone love and love in a charity match or exhibition match, even if you're as competitive as Nadal. They have done that sort of thing before.
But I don't think you can be halfway between being an exhibition and being full on. I don't see that.
You may well be right.
You can turn it on and off.
You may well be right, David. I'm just putting it out there that I don't know. I want to believe in it. I agree with you. The reactions seemed completely real to me. I believed in them in the moment, but equally there is a cynical portion of me, and I hope that portion is wrong. But the problem is, the questioning, isn't it? And yeah, look, I mean, first, the Ryder Cup is one of the best things in sport. I don't love golf, but I will always watch pretty much all of the Ryder Cup. I don't know about you, David. So I think the endeavour of trying to create that in tennis, regardless of anything else, is a worthy one.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I spoke to, in preparation for today's show, last night while this was going on, I exchanged messages with two of golf's correspondents. One is James Corrigan of The Telegraph. The other one is Ian Carter from the BBC. Just to ask them about how the Ryder Cup came to be what it was. I mean, I knew some of the history, that it used to be the USA against Great Britain and Ireland, Northern Ireland, and then it turned into, Great Britain and Ireland, and then it turned into Europe against the United States, basically because it wasn't competitive enough. It was too one-sided each time. And both of them said that it comes down partly because there are separate tours. There is a European tour and there is a US tour. And therefore, you bring them together in this three-day event, and it really works, and it's close, and Europe desperately wanted to sort of stuff it up the Americans.
But did it always have the significance that it has now, or has it had to build that up over time?
It's built. I mean, both of them said it had built. James Corrigan pointed to what he said was the war on the shore in 1991. I remember that. I think that was Kiowa Island. And he says, the thing is, the Americans were and are such the dominant force in golf, and somehow Europe bonded against them. What he does say, and this is his caveat to the Laver Cup in tennis, he says, golf has tried to mimic it with the President's Cup, which is taking place this week. He says, but nobody gives up, four-letter word. The Ryder Cup, it was a question of it being a perfect storm, that it just kind of worked. And whether you can recreate that in another sport that already has its own team competition with more than a century of history is another matter. And that is one of the questions I would have, is whether really what the Laver Cup's role is going to be is in creating a proper debate that leads to significant, meaningful Davis Cup change that turns the Davis Cup or a single team competition in tennis into a once-a-year thing that is effectively the fifth Grand Slam tournament, maybe with both men and women involved, nations involved, over the space of a week or 10 days, that feels like the Laver Cup. And maybe they join forces, present it like they've presented the Laver Cup, but have it country and country and country. I don't know exactly, but what I wonder.
I feel for the ITF, because they must be thinking, you know, finally, after years of players and journalists and everybody calling for it, finally they've, you know, embraced the prospect, you know, the principle of change. And, you know, they've had these board meetings and voted in complicated means various forms of, you know, bringing on change, and they think, right, okay, you know, we've done that. And then along comes the Laver Cup and rocks the boat hugely again. And I think Simon was very eloquent on, you know, the uncertain future and whether, you know, the ATP will embrace it. I agree with him that they cannot ignore it. They cannot afford to ignore it. And then if they start to embrace it, then you're left with all sorts of other, then it branches into all the other debates about, you know, the congested season. We're looking at a tennis season where, you know, one of the biggest points of debate is the fact that everybody's falling apart physically, and the season is obviously too long, and tennis has become so physically demanding, and yet you're adding events into the calendar. And then once you start branching into all of that, you're in just even more of a quagmire than when we started. So the other thing is, I'd love to see it involving the women's game as well. I'd love to see it be a mixed competition, but then, you know, again, quagmire. So let's leave that there. Fundamental problems for me are, I don't like Europe versus world as a, I just think that is a sort of convenient fudge to try and create a balanced a balanced set of teams. You know, I think Simon's point about the fact that tennis is probably the most unpartisan or non-partisan sport, I think that's a very important one, actually, that it's not necessarily something fundamental to Europe and world. It's actually in conjunction with something fundamental to tennis. But I do think that's a problem. You know, can we really imagine in Chicago next year the American crowd roaring for Kokkinakis the way they will for Isner? I don't know. I don't know about that. I think that's a fundamental problem. I think the whether or not it, you know, let's boil it down to the fundamentals, David. How many of those players would have been there this week had they not been paid? Had they not had they not been financially rewarded for being there?
From and if the we're, outset,
if we're comparing
very
it
few.
To the Ryder yeah. Cup, it, well, exactly, and I don't think that's necessarily a criticism because, you know, they're trying to create something from nothing. You know, maybe in the initial, in the first instance, money has to take the place of meaning, but at some point, meaning has to take over. Right, the money's a placeholder. So next year. Will players be putting their hand up to play without asking for a fee? That's going to be very interesting.
Well, I think that my guess is that they've got a fee structure in place so that they can keep supporting a fee-paying system.
For how long?
Well, if it's successful, it can just keep doing it, can't it? I mean,
then you'll never know if they're there. Well, players aren't paid. I mean, there's prize money, but there's no appearance fee to play at the Grand Slams. You know, that's not why they're there.
There are for many of the other tournaments.
Yeah, but there's not for the Ryder Cup, David. You don't want to feel to really...
Are you sure about that?
To really, really, really get behind the players in the way that you need to in this kind of team event. You can't be wondering if they're there for the cash. You have to feel like they're playing to represent their country or their region. You have to feel that.
Ultimately, yes, but many of these are seriously rich people, and fees to some degree is just ticking a box. It's to say, yes, we are paying a fee. I mean, they can make money. Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer can make money getting out of bed to do something else or to play an exhibition. They can make a fortune. So,
that applies to golfers as well, though.
I understand that, well. but the golf has got years and years of having built up what they've got.
Exactly. The money has to be a placeholder for something more.
I agree with you. No, I agree with you, but I don't think that that will be taken away. Players get paid to play Davis Cup. They don't get paid, I imagine, the same amount, but they get a fee for
it. But that's almost like
country.
A wage, isn't it, for their time? It's not a... That is absolutely not the motivator.
No, it isn't.
You know when you're watching Davis Cup that is not the reason why they're there. I've no problem with them receiving some kind of money, but I was
watching
it thinking...
Look how few of them are there, though, Catherine. How many of them are there at Davis Cup? That's a problem, isn't it?
I agree. But, okay, so then you get into the entertainment versus competitiveness argument. And again, I think Simon raised very well the fact that Laver Cup aside, that is still a fuzzy area within the sport. It's not perfect. You know, sometimes legitimacy is sacrificed in the name of entertainment, even at Grand Slam level. So he's absolutely right about that. But, you know, if it were all about winning, if it were all about getting the win for Europe or for world, Denis Shapovalov wouldn't have been there. I'm delighted he was, but, you know, when Del Potro dropped out, you wouldn't be looking to Tiafoe or Kokkinakis. You'd be looking to the next highest ranked world player. You'd be looking at Diego Schwartzman.
Yeah,
I totally
know what you mean, but I tell you, 30 years ago, before they changed the rules of the Ryder Cup, I don't think there are many British people who would have thought that they could have seen themselves as European for the Ryder Cup against the United States. That has built.
As Europe has built. And speaking of branching off into other areas of debate, David.
Indeed. so the.
I mean, look, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Not that I don't believe in a lot of these points I'm making, but I also hope and largely believe that these can be overcome with time, that trying to build something from nothing is incredibly difficult, and inevitably there will be these compromises and problems in the start. But I am optimistic that with some good decision-making and collaboration, potentially, it really could build into something. It could take a heck of a long time, but it could build into something resembling the Ryder Cup. I really hope so. I'm just saying, ignoring the issues at the moment that exist at the moment. I don't think acknowledging them necessarily poo-poos the whole concept. I think they
need to be acknowledged in order to overcome them or to build on what they've done here, which, as Simon rightly said, is a fantastic start, because they thought of everything. I was so impressed with that element of it.
The quality of the staging was unbelievable. I've not seen anything like that, you know, from scratch. You know, as you say, a standing start. I mean, my only issue really with the staging is that I didn't love. I suspect the Black Court looked amazing in real life. I don't think it looked as good on the telly, but I do think it was set off well by the. I agree with you about the country colours, the vibrant blue and red, against the grey court as it looked on the telly. That works.
And at the very least, there are parts of tennis that could learn a lot from what they've seen this weekend, I would suggest. Let's just get a couple of views from our listeners, some pros and those against. Vicky says, my Laver Cup verdict is that I love the whole thing, but one of the best things was teaching the young stars to honour past champions such as Rod Laver. And I take Vicky's point there, because 20 years ago when I joined the ATP Champions Tour for the first time, I don't work on it anymore, but when I did at that time, there was a real divide between the current day stars and those of the past, and they were constantly saying, oh, there are no characters anymore, and the players of the past were doing nothing to downplay that at all, because they felt cast adrift. They felt as though they were not part of tennis anymore, and tennis has started to embrace that in recent years. The ATP have done quite a lot towards that. I think some of the slams have as well. Commentary's helped with players still in the game, mentoring, and this was another step up from that. So I was impressed with that. Lizzie says, I loved every second of it. The team spirit, the atmosphere was incredible. I can't wait for next year's edition. Caroline says, I was very sceptical, but I absolutely loved it. I thought it would be an exhibition, but it turned out to be very competitive. Nick said it was definitely a success. Lucky Isner won, otherwise the final match would have been an exo. And it's a shame I wasn't able to watch all of it.
No, but they wouldn't have played the final match, as I understand it. They don't play dead rubbers.
Yeah, that's a slightly... I'm not sure how that would play out. But anyway, and finally, Jordan said it was so much better than expected. It could be huge in years to come. If people don't want it to be an exhibition, it won't be. Now, against that, Lucia says, just be honest with what it was. A weekend of purely exhibition tiebreak tennis not supported by the ATP or ITF. Is there really room for it? Mary says, OK, how cringe are the so-called celebrations from Team World at the Laver Cup? Ronan says, in grueling injury-afflicted seasons, is there really room for this? And Ali says, fans would have been annoyed, let's say, if they hadn't seen Federer on Sunday. No way that wasn't planned to ensure he played on Sunday.
Did you do some translation there? It was annoyed his original choice of vocabulary.
I did decide to use a different word on that occasion, so that I didn't offend my mother, who's listening to the tennis podcast.
We're so child-friendly here on the tennis podcast. I wonder how many pre-watershed listeners we have.
My mother doesn't like swearing. What can I say? So what do you think about all that lot? And what did you think of the point system, by the way?
I certainly think the way it panned out for them, they would say, you know, the ends justified the means. And I think there's a strong argument for the ends justifying the means. But if your end goal, and it's all the same point, isn't it? You know, maybe some legitimacy has to be sacrificed in the first place just to get it off the ground and to get people paying attention. But I think in the long run, if legitimacy is your goal, I don't necessarily think that can fly, because it's too easy. It's just such a, yeah, it's too glaringly unfair, really, isn't it? Made for fantastic entertainment, without doubt. And I think it was fine for this year and maybe for next year. You know, I think you're delving into the history of the Ryder Cup is really interesting, because I don't know how long it could take for this to catch fire. You know, it could be 100 years. I don't know.
I haven't really got 100 years, Catherine.
No, we're going to have to be cryogenically frozen and reawakened to witness, you
crack
know,
on,
the Labour
crack Cup. On,
but
Labour
but
Cup,
yeah, but I really, I would love there to be a Ryder Cup equivalent in tennis. I think the Labour Cup shows signs of the potential to be that. And certainly I trust the people that are involved in, you know, they've shown that it's in safe hands, I think. Absolutely. They know what they're doing. So, you know, let's not overlook the question marks over it and just all cheerlead it, because I think those question marks and debating them could be important to bringing it to what we all hope it could be.
So that's the Labour Cup.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, the race to Singapore is hotting up, Catherine. And actually, I mean, in truth, the vast majority of the places are pretty much filled, really, because players like Garbiñe Muguruza, Simona Halep, Elena Svitolina, Karolina Pliskova, Caroline Wozniacki, who won the title in Tokyo. And what a great performance from her. She's won her 10th consecutive year's worth of titles. She's not gone a year in the last decade without winning a title. Now, this one was a big one for her, because she was 0-6 from finals this year before she won that final yesterday against Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova. So she's basically there as well. And it really then comes down to two places. The seventh and the eighth position are the only ones that are likely to change or have a chance of being changed. And currently in seventh is Yelena Ostapenko, who won the title in Seoul yesterday in front of an absolutely capacity crowd. It was fantastic to see. Wonderful atmosphere there. And she has a small advantage over Jo Konta, who lost first up again in Tokyo. And this time, you know, she lost in straight sets and looked... she had some set points in the second set against Barbara Strizova, but she's looking a little bit ropey just at the moment. A couple of first-round losses in a row. The good news from her perspective is she has about a 650-point gap over Kristina Mladenovic in ninth. Who can't hit a barn door? I would back myself against Kristina Mladenovic at the moment. She's lost 8 matches in a row. She lost 6-love last week to Qiang Wang. And, yeah... Catherine Whittaker's forehand would be frightening as a prospect for Mladenovic at the moment.
Yeah, well, what on earth is going on with Kristina Mladenovic? That is people go through bad patches. I get that. I get how bad patches can be a vicious circle as you lose your confidence and, you know, it spirals. I get all that. And I get also get that Qian Wang is a good player on her day, coached by Peter McNamara, and, you know, has had some good results, particularly in the Asian swing. But 8 losses in a row and a love and love, something's going on there. I don't think there's sort of active tanking going on, because why bother showing up? But there's, you know, she's obviously not dialed in, is she? She's not dialed into tennis and her good. Like, you can't be, can you? She's too good a player to be losing this much and in this way if she is completely dialed in.
She looks pretty anxious out there too. I mean, it's almost as though she's got the yips a little bit. She just doesn't look comfortable and confident in herself in any way. I mean, she lost 6-3, 6-2 yesterday, I think. So that strengthens Konta's gap, that cushion. The one I thought was a real threat to her was Sloane Stephens, who comes in off the US Open title, and she's just lost 6-2, 6-2 also to Wang.
Yeah, maybe Wang could make a late run for Singapore.
I don't even think that's mathematically possible.
No, if only she'd started giant killing a bit sooner. I personally think it's a shame that Grand Slam champions don't automatically gain entry to the WTA finals.
They used to be in the men's finals. That used to happen.
Not anymore, I don't think.
No,
I think post Gaston Gaudio, I think they abandoned that rule.
I remember when Goran won Wimbledon, and he was so excited, and then somebody said, "Oh, and you'll also qualify for the Tennis Masters Cup," and he was like punching the air because he's basically done nothing else for a year, and yet he was going to make this massive money making final eight.
Both of them really, but I would be really disappointed if, Sloane Stephens less so, because it looks highly unlikely that she's going to quite. I know she still has a chance, but losing to Qian Wang really damages her chances, doesn't it? I think it'd be a great shame if Elena Ostapenko's not there. She could, just like she did in Paris, she could win the thing, couldn't she? She could easily win the thing, or she could, you know, disastrously lose in all her round robin matches and progress no further. But I'd really like to. Joe Conte is looking a bit ropey, but she sometimes does make a slow start. You know, in the early parts, she tends to maybe take a few tournaments to settle into a swing. That's the word I'm looking for, not a mini season. So let's not panic. This week, Wuhan's a big week for her, though, let's be honest. I think those two probably will get there. But it's a little bit of pressure for Konta, isn't it? A little bit of pressure for her to deal with. She didn't deal with the US Open pressure brilliantly well. Let's see. Because I think she desperately wants to get to Singapore, Konta. She'll no doubt be playing that down in any press she does, but I think she desperately wants it.
Particularly after losing out on the last match of the regular season last year to Svetlana Kuznetsova.
She was there at the draw ceremony and she was in all the photos and everything. I mean, she dealt with that magnificently, it has to be said, because that could have been the most spectacularly awkward thing ever, and she, her sort of good grace about it all prevented it from being that. So yeah, I think she'll get there, but it could be a shaky couple of weeks.
Actually, one of the players that is in striking distance is Svetlana Kuznetsova. I think she hurt her arm at the US Open, so I'm not 100% sure whether she... I think both Ostapenko and Konta will take those last two places personally. I think their gap is too big, and I think that they will get some sort of results in the next couple of weeks to qualify. And that would complete there's loads of players who won't be there who would be good to have there. Also, one I didn't mention is Venus Williams. She's in the top eight as well. She's going to qualify. it's a fantastic lineup if that ends up being what it is. So we look forward to it. And so there's Wuhan this week. They've just started that. And Beijing is next week, which is an even bigger event. And there's 1,000 points on offer to the winner of that. So things could change. But it looks pretty set, the final eight in Singapore.
I always... Now, sorry, David. Sorry to interrupt. I always sort of... There's a really sort of sentimental part of me that really wishes Wuhan well every time the tournament comes around, because Wuhan is Li Na's hometown, and the whole tournament was set up, conceived of, set up, you know, brought to fruition on the back of Li Na's success and bringing tennis to her hometown. And she retired about 6 weeks before the inaugural Wuhan Open.
I know. And, it looks like a fantastic event.
Oh,
and we know people who work
but
there.
That must
Eleanor
have been
Preston runs
just,
the media and...
just devastating. So I always sort of wish them well.
And they do struggle with crowds because, I mean, I'm currently watching Zhang Shui of China, and there's not many people watching. And it's a shame because it's such a good tournament. There's so many people playing it, so many good players. But anyway, I know what you mean. The Davis Cup has been played over the last couple of weeks and has ended up with a Belgium against France final. I saw some of the Belgium against Australia semi, and it was a heck of a comeback, actually, from Belgium in the end. And it involved David Goffin beating Nick Kyrgios in four sets to get level up at 2-2. And then in the final rubber, it was Steve Darcy who got them over the line. So a fantastic set of results there. And France victorious over Serbia, who didn't have Novak Djokovic, of course, because he's out for the rest of the year. But I think that'll be a really passionate final. I mean, they always are, aren't they, Catherine? But with those two nations so close geographically as well, I mean, I've heard that we're looking at a 30,000-seat stadium for that final. And you can just imagine, can't you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's going to be spectacular. I mean, they're two very contrasting nations, aren't they? France with the endlessly deep pool of talent, the perennial underachievers, certainly of late. I know they have won plenty of Davis Cups, but as you know, if you were going to characterise them as a Davis Cup nation of late, you would probably, I think, underachievers would probably, I would think that fair. And Belgium, I know they have David Goffin, very, very good player, but let's be honest, they're Davis Cup overachievers, aren't they? I mean, Steve Darcy, I don't know what happens to him when he plays Davis Cup, but he transforms. So I like that contrast. It's proper David and Goliath, I think, and it's going to be fantastic. Incidentally, what I don't think was fantastic, and I'm throwing a curveball at you here because it wasn't on our agenda, and we probably need to do a bit more research before we sort of delve into it, but Conchita Martinez being sacked as the Spanish Davis and Fed Cup captain, kind of out of nowhere.
Yes,
that was weird and a shame.
I interviewed her during Wimbledon when she was coaching Garbiñe Muguruza and asked her about her role as captain, and she was clearly hugely proud of being in those positions. I don't know the reasons behind it, I must say, and I agree. Real shame.
Well, I think she and the Federation differ on the what they consider to be the reasons behind it. But anyway, I've thrown a curveball at you, David. There, we'll look into it and address it again.
The US Open, Catherine, I didn't see much of you the last 3 days because you weren't too well. But just a couple of quick final thoughts. You got any?
The whole thing's a blur. I mean, my only thoughts of the last few days of the US Open involved sort of phlegm.
Oh, lovely. Thank you
sorry.
For that image.
Sorry. What were my thoughts? I mean, Nadal's amazing. I have to eat a bit of humble pie because I didn't write him off from winning it, but I certainly didn't see that coming. You know, as weird a tournament as it was, I certainly didn't see him doing that. So extraordinary from Nadal. I think as much as Anderson was the underdog and not many people were even expecting him to get a set, I still think he underperformed in the final and perhaps has reason to feel just a little bit, you know, like, maybe he could have done a bit better. And I as sort of heartwarming as this celebration was after the semi-final, upon reaching the final, I was concerned when I saw that. He did a Pat Cash in the stands.
I had no problem with this at the time because I completely understand it. But I kind of know what you mean. I feel as though really that was
his final,
wasn't
it? And if you were sat watching that and you had a ticket to the final on Sunday, I think you might feel a bit like, come on, Kev. You know, there's another match to go here, Kev. but yeah, Nadal amazing. And Sloane Stephens amazing. I don't know how much injury was a factor for Madison Keys in that final. I'm not sure we'll ever know. I suspect maybe a little bit, but nonetheless, Sloane Stephens amazing. Those aren't particularly great thoughts, are they? US Open winners amazing, but
we're just making sure Catherine Whittaker is that box is ticked, that we ask your opinion, given that you
basically
left me to it.
Champions amazing, little bit disappointed in Kevin Anderson.
Okay, thank you. Catherine Whittaker, that was a great bit of the podcast. Hope you managed to successfully fast forward that little bit. So pole vault. We have discussed Laver Cup in depth, so we won't do any more of that. The next gen ATP, which has kind of got forgotten a little bit in the last few days because of Laver Cup, announced the other day, Catherine, that they're going to have Hawkeye controlling every line. Line judge is a thing of the past, and only one official on court. I asked whether people liked the idea of that, and 46% said yes, 54% said no, which is quite interesting. What do you say?
I'm all right with it. I think it's starting to get to the point where they're just throwing too many things at the wall now. I can't keep track of all the weird and wonderful things that they're trialling at the next gen finals. It could be great. I think they're going to be in the same territory of. I think we're going to end up debating whether that's exhibition or legit. Again, I think we're going to sort of revisit that debate with a next gen tint on it in a few weeks' time. I've got no in principle issue with that being trialled. I just kind of feel a bit bamboozled by all the things they're throwing at it now.
Yeah, we've been involved in events before like Turbo Tennis where it was quite similar, that there were so many things being tried at the same time. Almost couldn't remember what the rules were.
Look, they could all be brilliant. And as I've said before, I like that in principle they're trying stuff. I like the openness to change. And maybe, when the event actually starts and we're watching it, it'll all, sort of become clearer and I'll have a handle on it again. But just in the build-up and reading about all the things they're doing, I just feel ever so slightly bamboozled.
Yes. The other pole vault is Nadal will retire on the following number of slams.
Oh, God. We don't know, David.
What are your favourites, Catherine? 16, which he's got now, 17 or 18, 19 or 20, or more than 20? What do you think?
I don't think more than 20. I certainly think he'll get another French. Beyond that, I don't know, David.
Okay, so 46% and more than 1,000 people voted in this. 46% say 17 or 18, and 31% say 19 or 20. So there's a lot of optimism out there. I read somebody the other day saying that they thought he could make 20. So we'll see. It's going to be very interesting.
He could make 20, David. That's not groundbreaking. He could make 20.
Yeah, but will he? That's the question.
Nobody knows. Saying
it's good debate, isn't it?
No,
it's not a debate.
Saying could does not mean yes. To quote the thick of it,
could I beat Catherine even with that forehand?
That's
what we all want to know. We're going to find
probably
out.
Probably wouldn't, but you
listeners,
could.
Is what's going to happen? Any other business, Catherine? You got any before I reveal mine?
No. I'm nervous about yours, though.
Mine's quite nice. Mine's really good news because just a lovely little storyline that's come through this week, that Alyssa Klebanova and Vicky Duval, both players who suffered from cancer over the last few years, played the event in Lubbock in Texas and met each other in the final. Klebanova won the final. Then they played together in doubles and won the doubles title, which is, I mean, it's just
that is nice.
I think.
Because weren't they supposed to meet in qualies at the US Open? Or did they meet? They were supposed to meet, and Vicky Duvall, or she either withdrew ahead of the match or she retired very early on in the match. In qualies at the US Open. I think the latter. I think she retired early on in the match, Vicky Duvall. So that's a really nice postscript a fundamentally not nice story, but thankfully one, touch wood, that has a very positive end.
Yes, and just a very final thought as well. Tornado Alicia Black, who is a young US Open junior finalist from a few years ago, and there was a great piece about her in the New York Times about how she suffered through injury and not being able to get on the tour, and she's ended up trying to coach to sort of help support her family and so forth. And she started a crowdfunding operation to try to fund this hip injury, and she's now $36,670 of the way towards $40,000, which is her goal. So she's only $3,000 away. So hopefully she's going to be able to make a career of it. So you can go and donate for her if you like, and try and help her out. But and it's nice to see that sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, good for her. In some respects, that's a quite harrowing story, really, that she's having to do that. But good for her, and what a great name she's got.
Yeah, well, her parents came up with the names for their two kids. She's called Tornado, and her sister's called Hurricane, which is, I mean, they're pretty spectacular names for marketing potentials and marketing reasons, and that's why they did it. But anyway, she's struggled to get onto the tour. Good luck to her. Hope she gets the surgery sorted out. Catherine, you off to practice that forehand in the rain this week?
I need to build up the muscle memory, so I'll have to practice it somewhere.
Right. I'm on course for this rematch. I'm so up for it. I've got my slice and dice game all figured out.
I don't play slice and dices, David. I'm above that now.
Okay, yeah, but that's what you're going to have against you, is all I can say, and you're going to have to deal with it. So, Catherine, lovely to talk to you, as always. Thank you all for listening. We've been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.